Church nerd is a wonderful phrase Reverend Shauna Lingood sometimes uses at the big church in Victoria. That's me, I thought to myself when I heard it. Most of my peers are happily spiritual but not religious, with no interest in being part of organized religion. I'm different than other people my age because I'm not just spiritual, but also religious. I am a church nerd. Diversity is a value that Unitarians hold so dear. Yet despite efforts to encourage diversity in our faith community, there's often less variety in the type of person who shows up on a Sunday than we were hoping for. This is a perplexing and downright frustrating reality that has resulted in people asking me one question so many times in so many different ways. Why don't more young people come to church? Whether you're speaking to me, a real estate investor, a Filipino caregiver, or a progressive conservative party member, in a Unitarian community, there's always a paradox in asking someone who is here why people like them don't come here. If you are interacting with us at a Unitarian event, you can assume that we are so interested in going to church that we actually do it. This means that we often don't know why most other people like us don't go to church. In this way, we're just not like those others. The future of our faith and our ideals of diversity are very worthy of consideration, but they are not my topic today. Mainly because I can't give more than a bumbling guess as an answer to this question. I first gave a version of this talk at the end of 2012 when I decided to start the process of not being involved in young adult activities anymore. I wanted to use the transition as an opportunity for a bit of reflection. Could I understand and articulate some of my personal experience as a young adult in a meaningful way? In this soul searching, I realized that what I did want to explore was what I'd learned about differences. Such fields as evolutionary psychology and behavioral economics have taught me that our minds are hungry for difference. We have an innate drive to categorize and judge and organize our world. The categories we come up with are kind of like shortcuts that break the world up into manageable chunks to allow us to make sense of what the heck is going on so that we can make decisions and function. There's nothing inherently bad about this human characteristic to categorize, but it is deeply powerful, and like most powerful things, we can do serious damage with it if we are careless. We are each different in a lot of ways all at once. I have crooked teeth, I cycle, my favorite color is blue, the list goes on. Trivial or profound, each characteristic makes me different from some and the same as others. Ignoring or celebrating differences, emphasizing similarities across difference, there are a lot of valid options in various circumstances for responding to differences, and they each have their strengths and weaknesses. But no matter what, there is no magical option that simply makes differences disappear. We are all responsible for the choices we make about how we respond to difference. Let's use a sampling of my young adult experience as a bit of a case study here of some of the issues that come up when people are different. While the details may not be the same, I'm hoping that some of my general observations will resonate. After growing up unchurched and then becoming UU over a decade ago in my mid-20s, it was only in my 30s that I settled into being seen by others as a young adult at church. As an oldest child, I'm used to being seen as old by others. Feels just plain weird to be young. I don't think I'm alone in this. The Unitarian communities I've been involved in didn't have robust adult young adult programming and representation. So young adults who strongly identify as young adults might find these Unitarian communities a bit of a lonely place. In spaces like this, it's often young adults like me that don't feel or act typically young that are more likely to find meaningful connection. I think I've witnessed a similar trait in some working class UUs, UUs from a non-mainline Protestant faith of origin, and other UUs who find themselves a minority of one flavor or another in our faith community. Those of us minority UUs that get most comfortable at church often don't identify as strongly with the thing that makes us a minority here as other folks from that group might. At the very least, we almost always have another part of our identity that fits in with the dominant UU identity. For example, like me, we may be a member of a helping profession or have advanced education that helps us fit in with other Unitarians. Depending on which way the demographic tides are turning, our differences can allow us to be early adapters that innovate and create space for others like us. And in some situations, we just remain few in number, fed by connections that are not based on finding other rare birds of our stripe. There are those differences that are apparent to us, whether we want them to be or not. Other differences that are important to us may need to be disclosed. Regardless of how important a piece of someone's identity is, it's common to have people emphasize the parts of your identity that they can see and minimize or dismiss other aspects that are less immediately apparent. Both of these things can really hurt. As much as we can manage, I encourage every one of us to stretch ourselves, to let people be who they feel they want to be, rather than who we think we see. This is what some people call the platinum rule. Treat others as they want to be treated. The ironic flip side for me of being branded a young adult, somewhat against my will at church, is that I got used to being seen as special in this way. I came to expect people to remember me as that young woman and would be confused with others at church younger than 50. A few weeks ago, I reached the age of 36, at which my young adult status officially expires, according to people who are keeping track of these things. I am officially no longer a young adult, so I have retired to being less special. I don't have kids, I don't make much money. As a boring old regular adult, I'm not all that important. From healthy to disabled or mentally ill, from employed to jobless or retired, those of us here who've been through a change in identity, where we move from being seen as more valued to less valued, know how transitory status can be. Throughout my young adult journey at church, I've often had this uncomfortable feeling that people see me as representative of all young adults. I feel the responsibility that what I said and did would influence people's expectations of everybody who's 19 to 35. What will people assume about young adults if I speak too quickly at the microphone, miss a deadline, lose my temper, or come up with a wacky idea that flops? It is hard to just be yourself when you feel like your actions reflect on a diverse group of people. My experience in our very loving community is the gentlest echo of the predicament of many of the social justice activists I've encountered in person and in writing. They want the freedom to be their unique individual selves and to not struggle under the burden of being seen to represent everyone who is different like them. I was exposed to this experience of minority activists while completing a bachelor's degree majoring in English and women's studies. Most people have got English literature figured out, but I have fielded a lot of questions about women's studies. My stock answer is that it is an interdisciplinary field that comes out of the feminist movement and includes various elements of arts and social sciences, especially literature and film studies, sociology, history, psychology, and political science. So there's my stock answer. The more interesting thing that I don't often get a chance to share with others is that remarkably little emphasis was placed on the topic of gender in women's studies. Feminism was a lens we used to examine such issues as class, colonization, the environment, sex, politics, and even religion, all with the broader goal of getting us to look again and again at the intersections in the web of life. The word systemic was our mantra, and the commitment that feminism be not just about women was more core to the feminist theory I studied than the fact that its origins came out of the struggle for women's rights. While classroom conversations were at times ludicrously theoretical and wordy, I will admit that, my studies were also deeply personal and transformative. We struggled with how very unfair life can be. We wrestled with how difficult it is to even figure out what is going on and what to do about it. We were challenged to resist band-aid solutions that would make us feel less personally uncomfortable, but did little to actually make things better. We learned that sometimes our role is to witness painful things and acknowledge that we do not fully understand them. Sometimes the challenge is to find a way to continue to not turn away from our discomfort. So we were asked to take the risk of looking deeply and doing our best to really see things for what they were. This feminist training profoundly influences my view of religion and my expectations of our religious community. All of our individual identities are a web of connection to people that we share similarities with, people who are different like us. None of us here feel at home by virtue of being identical to those around us. There is always something that makes us stick out, that earns us praise or suspicion, or that we cover over to try to fit in. The flip side of this is that the most tenuous connection between otherwise very different people can be a source of deep relationship. So what do we in this room have in common aside from my friends that I dragged here today? People of all ages and all faiths who attend worship in Canada are different together by the very fact that we even go to worship. While we may cringe to hear this, for many unchurched people, they'll see no meaningful distinction between us and a Pentecostal. It's all the same. Indeed, if we look at the recent history of our faith, we have much more in common with mainline Christians than we are comfortable admitting. The statistics vary, but they all agree that regular religious attendance is practiced by well under half of Canadians. By attending worship, we are in the minority. We are different than the majority of people who will walk by on the street today. And the general rule of thumb seems to be that the younger you are, the weirder you are for participating in organized religion, but perhaps not for the reasons you might expect. My belief in the supernatural or my choice of the Unitarian Universalist spiritual tradition is not usually suspect among young adults. As a group, my peers embrace the values of spirituality. They go on Buddhist retreats, incorporate Wiccan ritual into wedding ceremonies, perhaps even crack open a Bible out of curiosity. But they balk at the idea of being involved in the organized part of religion. It is religion as an organized institution that I find myself defending to my peers. We actively crave the spirituality and community part of religion, but are dismissive, uncomfortable, and sometimes downright resentful about the organization, structure, and institution that sustain religion. How come? I have some rough ideas, but don't take this as a final conclusion. It has become a truism that about half of young adults have experienced the failure of their parents' relationships. What is less remarked on is that while few of us are marrying or having children in our 20s, most of my peers have experienced the end of a committed partnership. We expect the partnerships of those in their 20s to end. I don't support young couples remaining together at all cost, but this expectation that we will experience a series of failed committed partnerships has resulted in some psychological shifts in how we react to commitment. I think a fear of commitment to religious institutions is in part one of these effects. Why risk wholehearted commitment when you expect everything that you allow yourself to deeply care about to fall apart eventually? If you fully commit, it will just hurt more. This theory is personal for me. In my late 20s, my first long-term relationship ended. In not too recent history, being in a same-sex relationship, living common law, and separating would all have been sources of stigma for me. But I was luckier to live in a kinder reality. What I did feel shame about, and what I worked so hard to hide, was how altered I felt by my grief at the ending of this relationship. A lot of my self-worth had been tied up in seeing myself as a capable and level-headed person. And I felt like that was slipping away. I caught myself regularly staring out the window, bewildered and agitated. While I had loved her deeply, my split had been simple in many ways. And I reasoned to myself that others went through breakups all the time and managed not to fall to pieces. I would not forgive myself for being unable to just get over it. My judgment was harsh and relentless. Most painful of all for me was that as I grieved my breakup, I believed in my bones that no one could understand my struggle to function. And yet I was surrounded by a religious community filled with people who shared my experience of moving from being part of a couple to being single. Some were even assertive enough to invite me over for tea and lovingly share their own stories of loss and pain. I likely could have found considerable comfort if I had just let these people in a bit more. And yet I didn't work up the courage to risk being vulnerable enough to admit what a mess I was. Sadly, for those experiencing such difficulties as addiction, bankruptcy, and abuse, for example, they can realistically expect some negative judgment from others, which makes the process of stepping out of this loneliness to connect all the more challenging. I realize that this last part of the story is a bit of a downer, so I'm happy to be able to honestly report that with some time and a lot of loving support from those around me and a healthy dose of professional counseling, I feel a lot better today than I did then. I wish I could also report to you that I've conquered my tendency to get caught up in the belief that I am all alone in my struggles. I continue to resist the tendency to isolate. I work hard at opening up, but I'm still unlikely to share with you at coffee time those parts of my identity that make me feel most vulnerable and alone. Even as I stand in a room surrounded by others who also carry loneliness and shame. It's a strange comfort to reflect that we are connected by this experience of feeling different. Knowing loneliness unites us at a deep emotional level that other more surface similarities don't match. It unites us with all people, remembering that we feel different just like everybody else. Helps deflate that sense that we are all alone. It nudges us to hope that reaching out is worth it and reminds us that we can make meaningful connection across difference. We can all be forgiven for looking around on a bad day and deciding that all other people are weird or that we ourselves are hopelessly flawed and will never fit in. I hope that on our good days, we can feel the meaningful bonds that unite us in our faith community and in our world, even as we continue to respect and acknowledge those things that make us different. So may it be, and amen.